Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It is Thursday, May 16th, and is Representative Gelser here? Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3474A.
Madam Chair, she's been stalking me for 2 weeks
now. I know. And Susan
now.
Waddell, could you come forward, too?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. And I can't help but notice that your committee is a combination of the two other Senate committees that I have recently visited. So I'm sorry if you're tired of me. I am here today to talk to you about House Bill 3474, which I believe is one of the most important bills we can pass this session to improve the safety in our schools and to help address issues of access to mental health services for students who are experiencing mental illness. If you look at your place, I don't know if these made it through from OLIS the first time around, but just so that you can have some of the materials from our first hearing, and I'll refer to some of these in my testimony. But House Bill 3474 is really very simple. It's about how consent is obtained for mental health screenings that are done in public schools. This bill does not mandate that anybody does a screening. It doesn't prohibit anybody from doing a mental health screening. It doesn't describe how a mental health screening would be done. It simply describes the method by which consent would be obtained and what happens to information once a mental health screening is completed. In brief, the bill would require, if a school district was going to do a mental health screening, again, a screening, not an assessment, a mental health screening of a whole grade level or a whole class, that they must provide written information by mail to parents or guardians at least 2 weeks in advance of that screening. That notice has to include information about who it is that will be directing or conducting the screening and who will have access to the information. In addition, this bill answers a question that is currently unanswered in the law, which is what happens to information once it is obtained through a mental health screening that's done in a public school. This bill would prohibit that information from being included in a student record. That means that that screening would be used as the tool that screenings are meant to be used for, to identify students who may need services and support. This idea was brought to my co-sponsors and I. It's co-sponsored by Representative Olson, Representative Springer, and I, because we live in the Willamette Valley region. Lebanon School District decided to do a screening, a mental health screening of their 7th grade students. They wanted to do this in collaboration with our local CCO, IHN or Samaritan. Samaritan is wanting to become more engaged in identifying risks for mental health issues earlier, since we know that 50% of mental illness will manifest itself by the age of 14. So what Samaritan said was, if you do the screening, if you allow us in to do the screening, we will do the screening, we will provide the tool, and we'll provide resources to the kids that we identify that need these services later. They actually just completed this process. They were able to screen 70 kids, only 70 kids of the 300 in the 7th grade there, and of that, they found 10 kids who were at immediate risk of suicidality. They were able to immediately get these kids evaluated by the Linn County crisis team with the permission of their parents. These were resources that were given to the parents, and then the parents decided what to do. They were able to offer these students access to treatment and able to provide the parents with resources and tools about what they might choose to do later. It was an enormous success. This bill would make it easier because students aren't good at bringing permission slips back in backpacks. The number of permission slips that came back was roughly equivalent to what you would have for anything else that you would put out there, which meant that about 70 kids were screened, and there were about 300 kids in that grade. So about 230 kids were not screened. When we do screenings for dental, when we do screenings for vision, when we do screenings for hearing, when we do screenings for scoliosis, we do it in the way that this bill describes. We send the notice, and then the parent can say, no, I don't want my child to participate. This bill goes a step further in saying the student can also say, I don't want to participate, right when they show up. So a parent can ultimately overrule a kid and say, say there's no way you're participating. Kid cannot overrule a parent. If a parent has said no, the kid can't participate. The kid can choose not to participate if the parent has given permission for the student to do it. So this bill, we believe, would make it easier for districts that are having these types of opportunities to collaborate with their CCOs to get this information to students faster and offer them resources. The psychiatrist, and she testified in the House Education Committee today, Dr. Caroline Fisher and her partner, Dr. Blummer, have clinics today in Corvallis, so they were unable to be here. But she described to us how well this worked in Massachusetts, where she recently came from. They implemented a similar program. They were able to reduce their inpatient crisis admissions for young people by over 60% because they were able to identify these kids early when these warning signs were manifesting themselves early and get them the access to the help that they needed before they attempted suicide, before they harmed another child in the school, before they got into a great deal of trouble. In the packet that you have there, there is an editorial from the Albany Democrat Herald talking about their editorial support of the bill. There is a copy of the screening tool that was used in Lebanon. And again, this was administered by Samaritan, and written testimony from Lynn Benton Lincoln earlier, as well as a letter of support from Disability Rights Oregon. As you can imagine, a lot of times disability rights organizations have concerns about screenings and the importance of that confidentiality of information. DRO testified in the House Ed Committee that it was satisfied that this was a positive development that would be helpful to kids. So I wanted you to have access to that. And I have with me today Susan Waddell, who's the superintendent of the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD, to answer any questions you might have about how these are administered today and why this is a bill that all of my local government leaders are urging me to support.
So my question is, the difference between what this bill will do and what is in existence now is you would have to do by mail, because you just send a slip home now. I mean, I was just wondering why 70 people. You have to have permission from the parent, is that correct, to do the screening?
Correct.
And so I'm still not sure what this bill does.
Okay. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Susan Waddell. I'm superintendent for Lynn Benton Lincoln Education Service District. And we have participated with the Lebanon School District and Samaritan within the screening that Representative Gelsler described. The way it works now is that parents have to opt in. You actually have to have a permission slip returned by a student or the parent so that you can conduct screening. What this does that would be different is it allows you to notify the parent that it's going to be conducted in a manner that the local community has decided on, and then the parent can say no if they don't want to, or the student can say no if they don't want to.
But it does not require that physical permission slip to come back.
I see. It's an opt-out.
Okay. And it doesn't require it to be an opt-out. A local school board would make that decision with their community. So they may still choose that for that community, that written permission slip back is what that community is comfortable with. What school districts have said is that the law is ambiguous. Some think that they may already have the authority to do it as an opt-out. Some don't. They're erring on the side of caution and have asked for this clarification.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Knopf.
Yeah. Page 1, line 15, so section 1B. I would feel a lot more comfortable if that language mirrored the language in sub A that explains that either a student or a parent or a legal guardian may request has the right to request in writing. So on the day that the student or parent or legal or guardian may refuse to participate, on the day of. So if you would just add that, I'd feel a lot more comfortable.
And can you tell me where that is again? I had the wrong version.
Yeah, so line 15, page 1.
Mm-hmm.
So it says explain that the student may refuse.
Mm-hmm.
So there's language right above that that says explain that either a student or parent or legal guardian. I recognize that the parent may not be there on that day, but they may be. And so I would feel more comfortable if that was included, kind of the same language as opposed to just the student. Because the student may kind of feel pressure. and, you know, maybe they'll, you know, want the parent to make the decision. And it just, it isn't clear, at least in my mind, based on that language.
And Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Knoop, I would be very happy with that language and the intent. The only question that I would have, I would want to make sure that in the amendment, it was making it clear that that parent could send that refusal to participate prior to the day of as well, so they weren't limited just to that day. I think what the intent was, and it's great to make it clear that up to the day of or up to the time it's given, they can opt out. I think it was intended to say that the parent can provide in writing, but that the student doesn't have to provide in writing. They can just say, no, I don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be very supportive of making that more clear.
Yeah, Senator Shield?
I'm not sure if either of you can answer this. This is slightly unrelated, but is there an age cutoff for a diagnosis of depression? You have to be at least X number of years old before you can get a depression diagnosis.
I'm not qualified to answer that, Senator Shields.
And we don't have our physician here, so I don't know either.
Okay.
I can, Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, I can contact Dr. Fisher tonight and get that answer to you by email.
Don't worry
about
it. I figured out. So, I was just looking for a shortcut.
Thank you. So you're saying that if a parent wanted their child to have a screening, but the student did not want to have the screening, that the student could override the parent in this case?
Madam Chair, I think if you look at the screening tool, because most screening tools are given to a student, it would be very hard to force a student to answer the questions if they chose not to answer the questions. So one of the reasons it says the student can opt out, we don't want to create a situation where a student is disciplined for not answering personal questions.
And Madam Chair, I would add that it wouldn't be valid data necessarily if a student was made to take it when they didn't want to take it. And it wouldn't necessarily show us what was needed for the student.
I've seen some of the surveys that we have our students fill out and they make designs on the survey. I mean, that happens even if they do take the test. Okay. All right, this is great. So as I understand it then, and Sandy, if you could submit that amendment, explain that the student or a parent or a legal parent may refuse to participate in this mental health screening on the day or prior to the day of screening, right?
Is that correct?
Yes.
And Madam Chair, I believe you have another amendment that I'm happy to support if you would like it, that would say that that notice to the parents should be culturally and linguistically appropriate. And that was a request that came from Representative Frederick.
That's the dash A2 amendment.
A2?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Sandy is going to get the amendment. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Then I will not put the submission in.
Okay.
Thank you for hearing the bill.
And there's no one else to testify, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3474 and open a public hearing. Since we have someone on the phone, I'm going to go a little bit out of order and open a public hearing on 2130A. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2130A defines substantial noncompliance to include criminal behavior, conduct that causes harm to a public or patient, impairment in a healthcare setting in the course of employment, sexual impropriety with a patient, positive drug test, civil commitment for mental illness, failure to participate in the program after entering into an agreement, and failure to enroll after being referred. It removes the lack of capacity to stand trial from the definition of substantial noncompliance. It allows certain boards to contract with other programs to deliver therapeutic services to the licensees. This has no revenue. It has a minimal fiscal impact. This left the House floor with 57 ayes and 3 excused.
All right, we have Gwen Dayton and Bruce Bishop to testify.
And then
thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm the OMA's general counsel. We're pleased to be here today to testify in favor of this bill. And I will be brief to say that we think the bill is an improvement, makes improvements to the systems that we think are important. I've listed them in my written testimony. I will point out one area in particular, though, that the OMA will be paying some attention to going forward, assuming this bill moves through. The licensing boards are given the opportunity through this bill to contract with appropriate treatment programs, and we think that's fine. But we would urge the board and all licensing boards, but particularly and selfishly for our constituency, the medical board, to do this through a public process, because I've heard from several physicians that they think it's really important that there be significant input into which treatment programs are chosen. And two, I've already talked to the board about that, and I'm sure that will happen. The second issue is we hope that they will select more than one, because I'm also hearing that one size does not fit all when it comes to treatment programs, and let's make sure there's appropriate options for physicians, because one of the OMA's primary goals when we read this kind of legislation and consider our position on the program and this legislation is, will physicians do it? Is it a program that is appropriate and people will go into the program and receive treatment they need? We don't want people in the community that need treatment that don't get it. And we think that the appropriate treatment programs is going to be really important for physicians to participate in it. And so we hope that that process will allow for both participation and more than one treatment program being selected, so there are options for physicians. And with that, I'm definitely available for questions, and I'll hand the mic over to my colleague.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, Senior Counsel for Northwest Permanente, a multi-specialty group that serves the enrollees of Kaiser Permanente Northwest. We testified on all three of these bills in the House, as we testified on Senate Bill 101 when it was before you. All of them address slightly different aspects of the same problem. Our written testimony on House Bill 2130 today is that you not move that bill, and that whatever you decide to move, you move within the context of House Bill 2124, the one bill that we think actually is the more significant of the three options that you have. The problem we have with all three bills is that there are good aspects of some of them and some other provisions that we think are not as desirable, and frankly, I'm not sure how you intend to mix and match those provisions or if you intend to move all three bills. But our recommendation would be that you not take action on House Bill 2130, that you take action on House Bill 2124. And put the provisions that you desire within that one vehicle. There is a specific concern that we have with the way that the bills were amended in the House regarding the responsibilities of the Oregon Health Authority and of employers to assure the adequate training of their supervisors. We believe that provision, the provision in current law is unnecessary. The amendment that was added in the House actually makes the problem worse rather than better. So we would recommend ultimately that you just not impose that kind of a statutory duty on employers or supervisors because of the workload burden that it creates for the Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you. So if you could just stay there. There's no one else here to... Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, there is. Never mind. Okay. Yeah. All right, thank you very much. And who's on the phone again?
I'm the medical director for HPSP, Jessica Gregg.
Yes, Jessica Gregg, please introduce yourself again and proceed with testimony.
Great, thanks. I'm Jessica Gregg. I'm the medical director for HPSP. And I have...
And HPSP is Health Professional...
Sorry, the Health Professional Services Program, which is the monitoring program that House Bill 2345 created for monitoring impaired health professionals.
Thank you. Proceed.
Yeah. So we had three points that we wanted to make about House Bill 2130. And I am actually not familiar enough with this process to know if 2130A is different than that. The one that I have read and that we've all read in HPSC is 2130. So the three points that we wanted to make were, first, that we strongly support the section of 2130 that removes the requirement that psychiatric hospitalizations need to be reported to licensing boards as substantial noncompliance. We think that this change will allow participants who are experiencing increased mental health symptoms to seek treatment without fear of being reported to their boards. And currently, licensees in our program may avoid obtaining the care they need in order to avoid a report of noncompliance. And so that's a very significant concern of ours, and we strongly support that change. There are two changes, however, in 2130 that we're concerned about. The first is the section that allows each board to determine if the medical director can be empowered to approve medications prescribed to participants in the program.
It'd be nice to, if you could, you tell us which section it is so that we can.
The copy I have doesn't have numbers.
Well, page such and such. Of course, if you don't have the,
I don't. I have.
All right. Well, proceed. That's all right.
Okay. So basically, we've learned over the nearly 3 years of managing the program that prescription drug abuse is a particularly devastating problem among our participants. And currently, the way we're structured now, participants have to report use of all controlled substances to the program. And then unless the situation is an emergency, they have to have those drugs approved before they use them. So, for instance, morphine or Valium or any of the controlled drugs. So that means that we are rapidly notified if a participant is obtaining opioids or benzos through, for instance, multiple ER visits or from multiple providers. And then we can intervene rapidly if it looks like they're doctor shopping or if this is relapse behavior. And then it also allows us to provide support to the primary care physicians who are often in it's a difficult position and they feel unsupported and they don't know how to manage these demands for pain meds, particularly from patients with histories of substance abuse disorders. And we have, let me be really clear, we do not have the desire or the ability to tell a clinician how to manage their patients, but we can offer resources like pain management referrals or substance abuse consultation with other evaluators if we notice a pattern of long-term use of opioids and benzos and if the clinician wants our help. And then we can also urge them to consult the PDMP, which is the database of that will show prescriptions for controlled substances that someone's gotten so that they can see if their patient is obtaining prescriptions elsewhere. And they often haven't thought about doing that. So we would like to retain the ability to do that, to approve or disapprove. We never disapprove, but to be made aware of all prescriptions for controlled substances.
And so,
Was there a question?
You're saying, as you interpret the bill, that this would not allow you to be able to. Be able to do what you're doing right now regarding
exactly
drugs.
Yeah, it would allow each board to decide whether or not they want us to do that, and we think it's important for everyone. It's a huge problem among our participants, and it's probably I don't know if it's the main way that we find people in early relapse, but if it's not the most important way we do, it's among the most important. People go in and often, you know, what happens is an accident happens. They put a nail through their hand or something and they go to the ER and it really happened and they get opiates and then something is triggered. And so then it starts sort of a cascade of going back to the ER for other complaints and then going back to other doctors when the ER doesn't let them. And if we can track that, then we can talk to those doctors and say, is this concerning to you? And if it is concerning to you, how can we help you?
But you're saying that the participants have to get approval of a drug, and if so, that means that they could not get pain medication if they really did put a nail through their hand.
No, they can. In emergency situations, they can just do it, and then they just send us the form later. But otherwise, we say, please let us know you have the prescription. Let us say go ahead and then take it. But in emergencies, they're always allowed to take it.
And the third thing?
So the third thing is the ability of the medical director to request a fitness for duty evaluation is also removed in this current bill. And we don't think that supports public safety. There are participants who present with very complex issues which can impair their capacity to function in their role as a healthcare professional due, for instance, to potential cognitive limitations, substance abuse, or mental illness. And they often require a comprehensive and thorough fitness for duty evaluation before they can return to practice. So, for example, someone may undergo treatment for substance abuse, but there may also be significant concerns on the part of the workplace or colleagues or other providers regarding their ability to practice safely for other reasons that may not even be related to substance abuse. And as a medical director, I have access to all of that information from all of those sources. And so sometimes even when the substance abuse problem seems to be doing well, if a person seems to be in recovery, there may be other concerns. And it is helpful for me to be able to say, I think this person needs further evaluation. And in this version, I don't have that ability.
All right. Questions? Well, if you don't mind staying on the line, we have two more who may be able to address some of these issues that you brought up. Courtney Thompson and Don Bose. Dr. Don Bose. And Karen Wheeler, if you want to address any of these issues. Dr. Bose, please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Courtney Thompson, Legislative Director, Oregon Health Authority. I'm going to let Karen speak to the technical pieces of this bill, but I just wanted to mention that we are working on an amendment that would, there was an amendment put in early on that we had some issues with later on, so this is a fix, and we've been working with the Oregon Nurses Association, the OMA, and Providence to work that out, and we're at a good place now, so we just wanted to make sure you knew that that was forthcoming.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. I just want to make clear that I am not testifying on 2124A. Amen. Karen Wheeler, Addictions Administrator with the Addictions and Mental Health Division, Oregon Health Authority. Sorry about that. I am not testifying right now on 2124A. I've been asked to provide some comments about 2130.
Yeah, that's what we're on now.
Okay. So as I understand it, there are three points that were you just heard about that are concerns, and you want some additional information from the technical side of the program. So the first concern was about public safety as it relates to the medical director being empowered to oversee the, and which I see as a monitoring function, the person that's in the program and their medications, the medications that they've been prescribed, their use of those medications, and it's not a clinical function, but it's a public safety function. So that's how we see the program. That's how it's being administered currently. And so that's about as technical as I can speak about as far as the function of the medical director in conducting those activities at the program.
Saying the function should be strictly from a public safety standpoint and not get involved with the actual prescribing and what medications they're on, et cetera. I mean, they're saying that that power was taken away in this bill. And is that correct, Jessica?
That's correct, yeah. And again, I really want to reiterate, we never tell any provider that they can or cannot do anything. We just look for patterns in use and then point them out and send people for third-party evaluations if the patterns are dangerous.
So, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, I believe the issue is this bill would allow the licensing boards to say whether or not the medical director could perform that function. And what you've heard is testimony that supports keeping the statute the way it is so that they can continue to perform that function.
But the bill takes away that function.
Correct.
All right. I get it now. And then the second one?
And then the second item that you heard about was the ability to perform the fitness for duty function. And in our perspective, the way we've administered the program, developed the rules, and worked with the contractor, which is Reliant Behavioral Health, that function is technically a critical function of the program because there are a variety of factors that contribute to a person's ability to practice, whether or not they're a nurse, doctor, pharmacist, or a dentist, in addition to substance use, recovery. It could be mental health or a combination of those things. So I think what you heard is currently the function of the medical director is to perform the analysis of the person's ability to perform or to practice on the job. And this bill would remove that.
The medical director? No. Remove the function of who to say that they're fit for duty?
The medical director to request a fitness for duty evaluation, which includes a variety of different components and factors and analysis of information.
And again, I never make the decision. I only make the decision that somebody else should. Basically, that there are enough elements that are concerning that the person needs an evaluation.
And the only thing I would add is that we've really taken the stance that this is a public safety program. So we've erred on the side of being very conservative in making sure that people are safe to practice. So when the original statute passed and we implemented the program, that was very much our mindset, was public safety.
And this is an agency bill or a... I'm trying to figure out who brought this bill forward.
Chairman Sanderson, this bill is not, the 2130 is not an Oregon Health Authority bill, no.
It's from the House Interim Committee on Health Care.
I know, but someone would have had to give it to them to do, and I don't know who did.
I think that was Representative Mitch Greenwood from the machine, I believe.
Thank you. That helpful. Okay. All right. And did you address the third piece on the...
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, if I recall correctly, the other point was about the training. And that particular item is addressed in the bill that the agency put forward. I will speak to that a little later when I testify on our bill.
Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Dawn Bost, and I'm in agreement with some of the statements that have already been made. I'm opposed to HB 2130A because I believe that licensing boards are primarily regulatory boards, and it's important to make sure that the licensees have the health care that they need in the intervention. And I think that the changes shift that back to the regulatory boards, which means that they then have the discretion to lean more towards regulation and punitive action. I think that the HPSP is a good program because I think it's objective and it allows licensees to obtain the health care they need. In order to return to practice and be licensed, physicians have to have third-party evaluations to start with. So that's already part of that program. I don't see that this would add anything.
Thank you so much. All right, any other questions? I think we will look at amendments. We're not sure what we're going to do with this bill, but I thank everyone for coming to testify on it. With that, I will close. Yes, thank you. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2130 and open a public hearing on, let's see, House Bill 2120? Yeah, House Bill 2120. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2120 authorizes the Health Professional Regulatory Board discretion to licensees regulated by that board to self-refer to impaired health professional program in which the board participates. This has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. House floor vote was 60 ayes.
And is this another Mitch Greenlee's bill?
Yes.
Yes.
I believe so.
All right. And he hasn't even lobbied me on these, so Bruce Bishop and Gwen Dayton.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton, General Counsel with the OMA. I'll be brief on this. We're fine with this bill. We think it allows the boards to not take self-referreds into the program. That's fine. The OMA hasn't been entirely sure that the HPSP program is really well positioned for self-referreds anyway, and my understanding is they're not a strong component of the program. So if the boards want to make the judgment that they don't want to take self-referred, we find that an acceptable judgment for them to make, and so that's why we think this bill is fine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, senior counsel with Northwest Permanente. You have before you probably the briefest written testimony I've ever presented to a legislative committee. So, because the HPSP is a monitoring program, not a treatment program, we don't understand why anybody would be self-referring to it. And so we think this bill is not necessary and would urge you to address any issues in this area through House Bill 2124.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
It's actually, maybe Ms. Dayton, you can help me with this question.
I'll try.
I'm looking at the language in this bill, and if you look on page 1, line 30, it says, was admitted to the hospital for mental illness or adjudged to be mentally incompetent. I'm a little worried. This refers to 676.190, and the other bill that we just heard, 2130, applies to 676.185. But I'm a little worried that these two might end up in conflict, so I just want us to, if we decide to move both of these bills forward, we're going to need to pay attention to make sure that we don't end up with new statute that doesn't coincide with each other. So I'm just, because of this issue has come up on several occasions about the hospitalization for mental illness, and I completely agree it ought to be permissible for somebody to get voluntary hospitalization. So I just want to be sure we don't miss that. That's my only concern.
Legis Council usually does that, and they give us conflict amendments.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Any other comments on this bill? Golly, these are easy. We brought them forward because we know that this impaired health professional program has been an issue in the past. Thank you very much. Close public hearing on House Bill 2120 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2124A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 2124A eliminates from the impaired professional program the requirement that employers of the program participants establish minimum training requirements for supervisors of the program's participants, modifies the provision requiring assessment of such employers, removes the admittance to the hospital for mental illness and court ruling of mental incompetence from the list of information that the program must report as evidence of substantial noncompliance with the diversion agreement when they entered into the program. This, too, left the House floor with 57 ayes, 3 excused. There's no fiscal nor revenue impact on the bill, Madam Chair.
All right. Karen Wheeler, Bruce Bishop, and Gwen Dayton. I should have just had you all stay there. Let's have Karen start first.
Oh, okay. Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee. Again, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the administrator for Addiction Services with the Addictions Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. I will mention first off that this bill is identical to Senate Bill 101, which passed out of this committee. I'm here to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2124. This bill provides two provisions to the Impaired Health Professionals Program. The Oregon Health Authority has implemented the program beginning 09, when the legislature passed and authorized us to do so, passing a bill. We contracted with Reliant Behavioral Health to operate the program. Currently, there's 4 boards participating in the program. As you probably already know, the Board of Nursing, Pharmacy, the Oregon Medical Board, and the Board of Dentistry. This bill eliminates language requiring the program to assess minimum training requirements established by an employer and retains the program's focus on assessing the employer's ability to adequately supervise enrolled licensees. Since the statute does not define the minimum training requirements or include a mechanism for enforcing this requirement, we support the removal of this language. The bill also eliminates the requirement for the program to report a licensee to their board as substantially noncompliant with their monitoring agreement when the licensee has been admitted to a hospital for mental illness or has been adjudged to be mentally incompetent. We believe removing this language is important to support this penalizes people for accessing mental hospitalization for mental illness or for seeking treatment for a chronic condition. I'd also like to just mention that there's a proposed amendment coming. It's a consensus amendment, so there's agreement among the parties, which would define direct supervisor, define that term, and also clarify the role as it relates to training under that section. And I'd be happy to answer any more questions or be a resource to you.
Let's go with Gwen and Bruce and then.
Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton, General Counsel with the OMA. We agree with all the comments that Ms. Wheeler just made, essentially. We like the changes in the training requirements. We think the original bill, or the original statute, imposed an obligation on employers to develop a training program. And really, again, getting back to my prior comments, the OMA's goal is to get people to seek treatment if they need it. And if employers have to take on burdens in order for a practitioner to go into the program, that's one more barrier that we would like to avoid, and we like the direction of the bill in that respect. We also are supportive of removing admission into the hospital as noncompliance for all the reasons that you can imagine. We think the changes in this bill and also the similar changes in other bills are appropriate. So we urge your support for the bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, Senior Counsel with Northwest Permanente. Our position is largely aligned with the Oregon Medical Associations and the Oregon Health Authorities. We too believe that the requirement for the OHA to assess the adequacy of supervisory responsibilities that an employer may have or that a supervisor may have is not a meaningful requirement and isn't necessary in the statute. Secondly, and this is the question that Senator Steiner Hayward asked about the hospitalizations for mental illness, we generally support encouraging patients to get treatment, and we don't believe that every hospitalization is necessarily substantial noncompliance, but some hospitalizations may be. So if somebody's hospitalized for 30 days or more, that may be an indication of substantial noncompliance with their agreement. if they need to go over the weekend into the hospital and, you know, they're okay to come back out, that may not be substantial noncompliance. And the problem with the drafting of the bill is that it's one way or the other. You have not specified legislative parameters about what constitutes substantial noncompliance. So even the overnight stay is substantial noncompliance, as is an extended stay in a hospital. And that's the area in which we think further legislative direction would be helpful. Absent that, you're leaving it to an agency, probably to define what constitutes substantial noncompliance. Generally, we support House Bill 2124 and would urge you to use that as the vehicle for addressing issues in this area involving the HPSP.
Great. Any other comments? Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little concerned, Mr. Bishop, about placing arbitrary limits on the length of hospitalization that could qualify as substantial noncompliance. I think we all know, or at least those of us who try to work with patients, even in the outpatient setting, when it's less serious, how long it can take to adjust medications appropriately for people for whom pharmacologic interventions are appropriate for mental illness. And I would be reluctant to call something substantial noncompliance based solely on the length of stay if it were because, for example, the physicians treating the impaired, the physician with mental illness tried a certain medication and there was an adverse reaction and then they tried another medications. Most psychotropic drugs have a very long half-life. It takes a while to get them up to therapeutic levels, and it may be more appropriate, if possible, to keep them in the hospital for a while to make sure that they go out safe and stable. And it might be very appropriate for a person to stay in that long to be in compliance with the physician's recommendations and then still come out and be eager and willing to comply with other recommendations. Am I missing? Maybe I'm misunderstanding your concern.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, our concern now is that substantial noncompliance is that whole continuum. We agree that some clinical discretion is appropriate, but we're not sure that every instance of a hospitalization necessarily warrants an intervention by the HPSP and follow-up for that patient. It may, but it is a difficult standard to try to put into law, because then the agencies will carry out your directive. It's obviously your prerogative if you think any time a patient enters an inpatient psychiatric facility, they should be reported.
No, I don't. But that's, I'm saying,
that's kind of the way it's.
No. I apologize for interrupting you, Mr. Bishop. I'm sorry. I'm saying I agree with changing it. I don't think it should be this way. What I thought I heard you say, and this may be where the confusion is, that you're saying that just having it be civil commitment is insufficient because there might be times when a longer hospitalization would indicate substantial noncompliance. I completely agree with you that a voluntary hospitalization for severe mental illness issues should not be adjudged to be severe noncompliance, and I think there seems to be a general consensus about that. My concern related to your, what I thought I heard you say, which is that a hospitalization over the weekend, which is the worst time to go into the hospital, by the way, is not noncompliance, substantial noncompliance, but a hospitalization for 30 days
could be.
Very plausibly be. I mean, I'm just trying to understand because I'm a little confused.
Our reading of the current law is that any hospitalization
constitutes
noncompliance with the agreement and triggers these subsequent interventions. We don't think that's warranted. And if you think some level of hospitalization may be, then you're the ones who need to define that line. We don't know what it would be either. But we don't want to create a barrier to people getting treatment that they need.
Right.
By there being collateral consequences for the licensee that basically result in them losing their license or being taken out of practice.
Right. Okay. Madam Chair, may I say one other thing?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I find that some of my confusion right now comes from the fact that each of these three bills deals with parts of this problem. And now that they're all three, I can understand why Chair Greenlee wanted them that way, because they do all deal with slightly different pieces of it, and maybe one part would go forward and one part wouldn't. But they're all out of the House now. And I guess my question to the three of you would be, would it decrease everybody's confusion and make it easier for everybody in implementation if you could figure out a way to put everything into one bill, so that we were sure that everything was consistent and we were addressing everybody's concerns? I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not going in with a preconceived notion, but if I'm getting confused having read these bills three or four times, I can only imagine that it might get confusing for others. I could be wrong.
Chair Monasanders and Senator Steiner Hayward, I think the answer to that is probably yes. And if it's the will of the committee that that be done and there's the time and things like that, I mean, the OMA would be glad to help put that together.
I would not want to take the chair's and vice chair's prerogative for insisting. I just wanted to offer a suggestion because there does seem to be a certain amount of confusion. I mean, this is a subject I've paid a fair amount of attention to over the course of my career, and so I'm a little worried that if I'm getting confused.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a prerogative of the chair to really just pass one of these bills, but if it's the will of the committee to put two of the bills into 2124, I'm certainly open to anything.
Madam Chair, I would welcome and we may not come up with anything, but maybe make the attempt.
What happened to the Senate bill? Did it die over there?
No. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, it's scheduled for a work session in the House side, Senate Bill 101.
Huh. The problem is we're more organized. We want to make sure we have a bill, 2124, and so we'll see which one gets through the system.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Courtney Thompson at OHA. I think the problem that we're facing is that there's not agreement on all three bills, so to merge them may not be as easy as it sounds.
And that's the prerogative of the chair, but if committee members feel differently, I'm certainly willing to work with it.
Madam Chair, if I may, just one additional comment, and I'll be brief. To Senator Steiner Hayward's concern, part of the problem in the drafting, I think, is that the provision that you're looking at refers to both admission to the hospital for mental illness and a judge being adjudged mentally incompetent. Those are two different things. So when you strike that entire provision, you're taking them both out under these bills.
But 2130 wouldn't, because 2130 would add back in civil commitment, right?
No, it's existing law right now, and so the conflict amendment would take care of that.
Okay.
Just look at the bold part of what they, how the law's changed, and yeah, no, that would have been taken care of.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
We have one more.
Yeah. So, colleagues, those are the three bills, and there are amendments for each one of them. What I would like to do is, once we get the amendments, talk to each one of you to see where you are on any of them and see where we want to go. Okay. Thank you. Did I close the public hearing on 2124A? I will do that, and then open a public hearing on 2132. Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, 2132A directs the Board of Directors of the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation, or Cover Oregon, to report to the Legislative Assembly and certain other parties on efforts made to coordinate eligibility determination and enrollment processes for qualified health plans and state medical assistance programs, declares an emergency effective on passage. House floor vote was 58 ayes and one excused, one legislative business.
Mr. Hummel.
Chairman Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm the state and federal policy director for the Oregon Primary Care Association. OPCA is a nonprofit membership organization comprising Oregon's 31 community health centers. Our members operate 201 health clinics statewide that provide coordinated care on an annual basis to 330,000 rural and or medically underserved patients annually. The majority of our patients lack insurance or are covered by Medicaid. I request your support for House Bill 2132. As Oregon health plan members' incomes fluctuate, they will move between coordinated care organizations and qualified health plans on Cover Oregon. A recent national study concluded that once health insurance exchanges are established, within any six-month time period, more than 35% of adults with family incomes below 200% of the federal poverty limit will experience a shift in eligibility from Medicaid to coverage provided by an insurance exchange. Additionally, within any one-year time frame, an estimated 28 million individuals will transition from coverage through an exchange to Medicaid. And a recent Oregon Health Authority study estimated the number of Oregonians who will annually transition between CCOs and Cover Oregon plans will be 60,000 in 2016. Now, these transitions should be managed carefully. We have to ensure continuity of care. Smooth coverage transitions are particularly crucial to minimize disruptions in services for people who are in a prescribed course of treatment, as well as those with complex healthcare needs. And appropriately managing this churn produces savings to the system, as any healthcare coverage gaps lead to slippage in people's health and increased use of the most expensive care options, such as emergency rooms. Now, House Bill 2132A, it requires the Oregon Health Authority and Cover Oregon to work collaboratively to coordinate eligibility determination and enrollment processes for qualified health plans and state medical assistance programs, and to regularly report to the Legislative Assembly on the coordination of these efforts. The bill is the result of a consensus reached by the Oregon Primary Care Association, OHA, and Cover Oregon. As you heard, it passed unanimously off of the House floor. Cover Oregon and OHA are in the room to answer any questions you might have of them. We have a pending -4 amendment that addresses a minor technical oversight in the bill. The bill, as currently drafted in front of you, requires OHA to report quarterly to the Legislative Assembly and Cover Oregon to report annually. The intent of the bill was for both entities to report quarterly, and the -4 amendment will require that. That's all I have available for questions if you have any. Thank you for your attention.
My only concern with the bill is we are asking them to start these reports when we aren't, I mean, we're still in the infancy, and my prerogative would be to let things settle out. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, what is the urgency of implementation of this right now?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Oregon Primary Care Association learned a lot through this process. We were very encouraged to learn that the Oregon Health Authority and Cover Oregon have already started working on this issue. They have plans in place. I mentioned the Oregon Health Authority, a study that indicated the amount that they estimate will be churning by 2016. So Cover Oregon and the Oregon Health Authority have already started work on this. They've shared some of the reports to the Oregon Health Policy Board. There's been reports on this. So both agencies are well along. So the reporting that you'd get now would be the systems that they're developing. You know, the reports as you get further along will be the number of people who are actually churning and how the systems are working. But both agencies are here if you have questions for them. But I'm confident there are things to report about now.
So we really don't need the bill since they're already doing it.
Well, no, it's good to track how things are going, and that's what both agencies have indicated they would probably be doing anyway. So you could say, why do we need the bill? But I think it's important to have, because both, particularly Cover Oregon, is going to have so much on their plate. If things aren't called out, they might slip, not because of a lack of interest, just because of they have to prioritize certain things, and OPCA would like this to be prioritized.
Thank you. David Barenberg, would you come on up?
Good Good afternoon. My name is David Barenberg, representing Cover Oregon. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. We have worked with the Oregon Primary Care Association, other advocacy groups, and with Oregon Health Authority to come up with the bill that is before you. There were other iterations before. We feel very comfortable with working with our partners and reporting to the legislature. We'll be reporting in a consistent manner anyway to the legislature, and this is another item that we are happy to include. And it is something, as Mr. Hummel has said, that we are working with, we are talking with advocates on, and believe is an important issue that we need to really scrutinize in making Cover Oregon a success for those who are most in need of coverage. So we look forward to working with our partners and are fine with the bill as it or the amendments as they will come to you. Thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead, Brian, since you're up here too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brian Niebert for the Oregon Health Authority. I just want to echo Mr. Barenberg and Mr. Hummel's comments, supportive of the bill, and feel this is completely appropriate for us to be reporting on, and are comfortable with the bill and the forthcoming amendments.
Okay. All right. There seems to be no opposition. Everyone's kumbaya, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2132A and open a work session.
No, we need an amendment.
No, we need the amendment.
Oh, we have an amendment.
Okay. We will
close the work session on 2132. Thank you very much, committee. We're adjourned.
No.
Oh, can we reopen?
Yeah, you just did.
Reopen?
You have an informational, Madam Chair.
Oh, Mother's Milk Bank.
Yes.
There you are.
Sorry that I like blurted out. No.
I forgot.
You usually say to me.
Is there anything else?
Madam Administrator, is
there anything else? This time I didn't.
And you didn't.
Hi.
How are you?
Well? Good to see you, Helen.
Good to see you, too.
Yeah, go ahead. Is anybody on the phone then?
No.
Okay, then I'll turn this off.
I deal with these all too often.
Please proceed. All right. My name is Leslie Mondu, and I'm an RN and lactation consultant, and I'm the co-executive director of Northwest Mother's Milk Bank, and very happy to be here today to share with you our project and what's happening with Northwest Mother's Milk Bank. I am kind of going by my slides that I presented, so some of my narrative will kind of match up with that. I have worked for the last 27 years in the state of Oregon, very fortunate to be in a state with one of the highest breastfeeding rates. And I'm anxious to share with you our passion about this project and how it will help our smallest Oregonians. Our premise is that human milk is for human babies, and we have many supports on both the professional and national levels for this project. Our mission is simple. We're going to collect, pasteurize, and distribute donor human milk for medical needs. Oregon's rate of prematurity is 9.9%, and human milk is life-saving for this medically fragile population. Immediately after birth, a mother of a preterm infant may be unable to produce enough milk due to stress, due to separation, medical complications, all affect her ability to make milk. The demand for donor milk is growing. The Human Milk Banking Association of North America in 2010 dispensed over 2 million ounces of donor human milk throughout the United States and Canada. But had they met all of the orders that they received, they would have needed 8 million ounces. HMBANA is our governing organization. They set the standards and the guidelines for donor screening, milk pasteurization, the microbiological testing of human milk.
There are 12 milk banks, which we will soon join. The closest is 600 miles away. The closest milk banks are in San Jose and Denver, and hospitals throughout Oregon who are using human donor milk order their milk from those banks. Very expensive shipping costs because the milk has to come on dry ice overnight, FedEx, so the cost is very high. Our milk donors are not paid. They have an inherent need to help a baby other than their own thrive. One of the most common questions we get from women who call is, where will my milk go? Who is it going to help? We have four major steps in our screening process. We do a phone screening asking lifestyle questions, some just kind of history. We send them a packet of information with quite a lengthy health screening form, which they fill out. We get medical releases from both the milk donor's physician and the baby's physician. And then we do blood testing to test each mother. That's our final step in the screening. The milk arrives at our milk bank in a frozen state, so moms bring it in frozen. At the bank, the milk is thawed and then maybe pooled with milk from multiple donors. It's gently mixed, poured and bottled, and then pasteurized in using the holder method of pasteurization. And then each batch that is pasteurized, a sample is sent to the Oregon State Public Health Lab, where they will be testing the milk for the bacteriological standards. Milk is dispensed after those tests come back, and we know that the milk is free of any bacterial growth. We do charge a processing fee for the each ounce of donor milk that's dispensed, and it does require a physician's order. We have been working for 5 years, a dedicated group of volunteers comprised of nurses, physicians, lactation consultants, business owners, lawyers, moms, to promote awareness and educate about the need for a community milk bank in the Pacific Northwest. We have a home. Providence Health and Services has donated a 1,500 square foot space to us, lovely space in a doctor's office, main floor, easy access for moms. We have been doing lots of fundraising, and our goal is to become completely self-sustaining by 2015. We are going to continue fundraising, raising another $450,000. We plan to achieve that goal by grant writing, innovative fundraising. We have a variety of grant proposals pending right now, and just this past weekend we partnered with New Seasons Markets where they did a bake sale, sold cupcakes for Mother's Day with all the proceeds going to us, and people could make cash donations at the registers. Many of our fundraising dollars to date have gone to renovations and lots of equipment, commercial freezers. We have a big automated pasteurizer that is due to arrive from the United Kingdom. That's the only place that they're made. That's due to arrive in June. We now have four part-time staff members and a wonderful group of volunteers who are committed to opening our doors. In the last 5 years, we've opened 12 milk drops throughout Oregon and Washington. A milk drop is a local community place where a mom, once she's been screened, can bring her milk, and it stays there in the freezer and then is sent to the milk bank. Currently, those milk drops are sending to Denver and San Jose, but once we open our doors at the end of this month, they'll be sending that milk to us. We have a goal of developing at least 30 milk drops throughout the Pacific Northwest by the end of 2015. We've made great progress in the last few months. We started screening donors in April. As of this morning, we have 31 women in the process somewhere of being screened. We're writing protocols, equipping our space. We have two representatives from Himbana that will visit our bank on the 27th and 28th of May who will go through the final assessment to give us the okay to open our doors. So we fully expect to be putting milk out the door in early June. We're very excited about that. Our goal is by the end of this calendar year to have 15,000 ounces dispensed, and by the end of 2015, 100,000 ounces, hopefully meeting the needs of the Pacific Northwest. With that, I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Blanca, who will talk about the power of donor milk.
Okay. Thanks. Chair Monis Anderson and committee members, thank you so much for the opportunity to provide some testimony today. My name is Helen Blanca. I'm a family physician, and I'm a member of the Northwest Mothers Milk Bank Medical Advisory Council. I'm here to share a medical perspective on the benefits of donor milk. The evidence that breast milk is the optimal nutrition for infants continues to grow. Human milk provides hundreds of known nutrients, vitamins, minerals, immune factors, hormones, and biological factors that are known to be crucial to the optimal growth and development of a newborn. Infants who receive breast milk as their primary nutrition in the first year of life have fewer infections, lower rates of asthma, diabetes, and obesity, and improved cognitive development. When a child is born prematurely, however, the benefit of human milk over synthetic formulas is even more dramatic. Premature infants have underdeveloped intestines that are not prepared to digest food, and so it's crucial that the food they receive is as easy to digest as possible. There's a substantial difference between the ease of digestion and absorption of human milk compared to formula made from cow milk or soy milk. Premature infants are also particularly susceptible to serious infections of the blood and lungs, and human milk provides immunological support to fight those infections that formula does not. Premature infants are cut off from the maternal supply of hormones, biological factors, and specialized fats that they would have received if the pregnancy had lasted longer, and these are most nearly approximated by donor human milk. It's crucial that hospitals that care for premature infants have access to donor human milk because the mother's own milk is not always available. The mother may be pumping and trying to breastfeed her infant, but her milk supply may not have come in yet or may not be sufficient to meet the baby's needs because it wasn't designed to do so until the full term of the pregnancy had expired. The mother may be too ill to provide her own milk because of cancer, trauma, or a severe health condition. The mother may choose not to breastfeed, but her infant's physicians may recommend donor human milk in those most crucial first few weeks. And in the worst cases, of course, the mother may have died during childbirth, and so that would be a reason to use donor milk as well. Because the evidence of benefit of human milk for premature infants is so strong, the American Academy of Pediatrics now recommends that if a mother's own milk is unavailable, donor human milk should be used for these infants. The World Health Organization and UNICEF also recommend using donor human milk when the mother's own milk is not available. A human milk bank is vital for safe donation because donor mothers need to be screened for infectious diseases, as Leslie mentioned, and the milk needs to be pasteurized to kill harmful bacteria that may have contaminated the milk during pumping or storing. The milk can then be pooled to optimize nutrients and dilute any potentially harmful substances. Currently, Oregon's neonatal ICUs are ordering human milk from milk banks in Denver and San Jose, but these banks are only to meet about half or slightly less than half of the need that we have here in Oregon. The healthcare providers who care for our sickest infants are committed to providing human milk to those infants because they recognize the clear benefit. But even though they're writing orders for these milk, these orders cannot be filled because there's not enough supply from the existing milk banks. At the same time, we have a huge established base of milk donors here in Oregon who want to donate milk, and that milk is currently being shipped out of state for processing. The Northwest Mothers Milk Bank is a desperately needed resource. The milk can now stay here in Oregon to fully meet the needs of our most fragile infants, and it's really wonderful that that resource now exists. Milk banks prioritize recipients when they're looking to determine who to give the milk to. They prioritize the recipients based on medical need, with premature infants who are currently in the neonatal ICU being the highest priority recipients. If the supply is sufficient, then the donor milk could also be used for full-term infants who have special medical conditions, allergies, or sensitivities that they would need human milk over formulas, or for adopted infants when their adoptive parents want to give them human milk. There is strong evidence that premature infants in the neonatal ICU who receive donor human milk have shorter lengths of stay in the hospital, they have fewer serious infections, and they have fewer cases of necrotizing enterocolitis. It's worth mentioning that particular condition because it is sort of one of the hallmarks of what determines the course of a premature infant. Development of this condition or not development of it can severely impact that infant's entire hospital course and certainly their entire life.
Necrotizing enterocolitis is a serious disease of inflammation and infection in the intestines that can occur when vulnerable infants are trying to process food through their immature systems. The intestines become severely inflamed, and sections of the intestines can die, resulting in perforations. In the worst cases, surgery is needed to remove sections of the intestines, resulting in lifelong feeding problems and disabilities, as well as higher risks of death and enormous costs. Necrotizing enterocolitis occurs in about 1 to 7% of all admissions to the neonatal ICU, which in Oregon translates to about 30 to 50 cases a year. Donor human milk would likely prevent 75% of those cases, resulting in immediate cost savings of $7 million to $15 million a year, as well as preventing the severe suffering of these children and their families. It's important to note, too, that prematurity is a health equity issue. African Americans and Native Americans, and in some cases Hispanics, are overrepresented in the population of premature infants in the neonatal ICU. While donor human milk would benefit every infant born prematurely, it would particularly benefit communities of color and infants who are at risk for necrotizing enterocolitis. Thank you for the opportunity to share information with you about the Northwest Mothers Milk Bank. It's a desperately needed health resource in our state, backed by strong scientific evidence of efficacy and the endorsement of major health organizations. We know that milk banks yield a huge benefit to states. In fact, the return on investment is close to $90 for every dollar spent in terms of long-term health savings. Opening the Northwest Mothers Milk Bank is the right thing to do for our most fragile infants and their families. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. My name is Amber Heckman-Pucci, and I'm here as a milk donor. And I thank you for your time. Your time is important, but anybody who's ever loved a baby knows this is an important issue, too. I'd like to begin by rewinding, and not crying yet, rewinding a year ago to when my second child, Rosalyn, was born. When she was 11 days old, I found myself at Doran Becker Children's Hospital with my little 7-pound baby in the middle of this gigantic bed, and she had not eaten for 3 days. She was on maintenance fluid. Her lungs were collapsing. She had a virus. And the nurse finally turned to me on the third day and said, we're going to insert a feeding tube through her nose, down her throat, past her stomach, and into her intestines. Which formula would you like us to use? And at that moment, I thought, man, you can become in need so fast. 11 days she'd been with us, I still didn't know her. But thankfully, the stress hadn't gotten to me yet, and I was able to produce, and as I watched, 2 cc's an hour they gave her, when I watched that drip into her feeding tube, I was very thankful I was able to give her the best healthy start that I could. Not all moms can. Now I'm going to, since I'm rewinding, let's go back more than 3 years. When I was anxiously awaiting the birth of my first child, Maximilian, and I was doing my homework, doing the hospital tours, and I got information, packet of information, on the new moms group at Providence Newburgh, along with just a flyer on, kind of an invitation. If you'd like to donate milk, this is how. And, at that point, I hadn't really run in any mom circles yet. So the idea that I was growing a baby in me was weird enough. But to think all of a sudden when this baby made his grand entrance or exit, whatever perspective you have, all of a sudden, thank you so much, to all of a sudden have these superpowers to nourish my baby, that was beyond my scope of understanding at that point. So I decided, if it works for me, I'm going to donate as kind of an offering of thanks. And when Max came, I was almost literally dripping with good fortune, and we were able to donate. And the whole donation process was quite easy, as was explained. I had a phone conversation with a nice lady in Denver, Colorado, at the Denver Milk Bank. When I went through that screening process, then she sent me some vials for blood collection that I took to the local hospital, and I got a quick blood draw. Usually, I just use it as an opportunity to show off my new baby. And nurses were nice about it. And once I was approved for that, then I was sent some supplies, some bags to store the milk and some steaming bags to steam some of the equipment that I used to collect milk. When Max turned one, then I retired as a donor when my child turned one. But when Roz was born, I continued to donate. However, with two kids, half-year-old who was mad that I brought somebody else into the house. You know, her tough start and some medical stuff of my own, I wasn't able to donate as much as I'd like. But Leslie helped me understand that when we're talking about tummies the size of a pea, or maybe a marble, or, you know, a whopping ping pong ball, it's drip by drip that we're helping these babies in very, very real ways to get the best healthy start that they can. The last part of being a donor was just to transport the milk from my deep freeze to a depot. And in this case, I was just a number of blocks from Providence, Newburgh. And with Roz, when I had two kids, I would just, when they fell asleep in the back seat on the way home from the grocery store, I'd zoom home, get the milk from the freezer, go to the parking lot of the hospital, and call them, Joanne, I'm in the lot. Come get it. And we'd make the switch. And I'd never even have to wake up my kids. Just as easy was the milk that Max shared, my firstborn, because I was taking advantage of the new moms group, which was literally four doors down from the lactation room where I would drop the milk. And it was at this new moms group that I heard that this whole process kind of made the connection that I really want to leave you with today. I heard so many stories about these premature babies that just needed the best healthy start to make all the difference. At that moment, not it couldn't come later. And lots of cases, the premature babies are twins, you know, there's more going on. As was the case for Autumn. As I sat in, I'm sorry, I've told this story before and I can't get through
this. That's all right.
As I listened to Autumn and Noah's mom talk about their first days of life and how they came a little early, they were twins, and she had always wanted to give them the best good start. She wanted to breastfeed, but her body just wasn't ready to give. And she said they were recipients of donor milk. And I know the chances of any of my milk being given to Autumn or Noah are very, very slim. But at that moment, I realized I was absolutely a part of a bigger system that helped babies all the time in Autumn and Noah's position get the best healthy start they could. And that shifted my idea of who I am in not only my community, but kind of my potential. And so when we have this conversation about human milk banks and how they're important not only dollars-wise and cents-wise, I know we'll talk about the babies, and I know we'll talk about the moms, and I know we'll talk about the medicine, but let's not forget to talk about the donors, because milk banks are also helping us reach our full potential, drip by drip by drip. And I thank you for your time. I apologize for the tears.
No, it's very impactful, and it makes us just become more aware of what the donors, because you don't think about the donors. I have some technical questions.
Sure.
I mean, you say you're going to be sustainable. So when a hospital needs donor milk, will they then purchase it from your donor bank?
Yes.
And how much does that run? I know I'm getting into, you know.
Sure.
And then do the donors get compensated at all?
No, the milk donors are not paid. The hospitals pay a fee per ounce. And so in looking at milk banks across the country, kind of a general range is they pay anywhere between $4 and $5.50 per ounce, which covers...
Doesn't seem like very much.
Covers the whole fee of all the pieces and the screening of the moms and that kind of thing.
And is it pretty much standard, the prices?
It varies a little bit, but generally, yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's I know that hospitals do this differently, but a lot of times the NICUs consider that room and board. It's just charged as part of room and board. Right. Like, depending on the neonatologist and how the NICU is run, some feel so strongly about donor human milk for preemies that they just, that's the standard. Like, all babies in their NICU are going to get donor milk, and they just add it to the room and board charges of the hospital. So insurance companies pay for it a lot of times, so... It's part of the standard fee of NICU stay.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you're done, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I am.
I mean, just on a very personal note, I empathize completely with what you're saying. I had my second child in January, and my older, not this past January, but 14 years ago. 14 years ago. No. Sorry, I wasn't being clear. In January of a year, so it was the winter, it was RSV season, which is this nasty, I don't know if that's what your daughter had, but my older daughter was 3, and most kids have had this nasty virus by that point. Unfortunately, mine got it 3 weeks after the baby was born. And my second child got very sick, and she was a little bigger. She was about five and a half weeks, but she'd been born 3 weeks early, so she was very vulnerable. And, you know, I'm a physician. I'm a family doctor. I deliver babies. I push breastfeeding. I do all those kinds of things. The scariest thing, as you know, is seeing your baby surrounded by, and my husband's an ED nurse, right? So when two medical professionals see 7 people, first question they asked us was, do you smoke? Thank God I was able to answer no. But later the question was, have you been breastfeeding her? And I said, well, of course. And they said, she had new formula. I said, uh-uh. And they said, you probably saved her life. And that's a pretty great feeling for a mom. 7 weeks after that, my sister-in-law had much anticipated, much desired twins 4 weeks early. And I flew back to New York with my 12-week-old baby and a lot of extra milk on board and promptly breastfed my niece and nephew in addition to my daughter and pumped for my sister-in-law too, because she was, you know, having to cope with twins and, you know. And it was just an incredibly powerful experience to be able to contribute to that. And then on the adoptive front, I have another good friend who, you know, again, had hoped very much for a child and ended up getting a newborn through adoption and really wanted her child to have the best start and ponied up. And $4 an ounce, I mean, when you're... Those 3-month-old babies go through a lot of milk. We don't measure it when they're getting it directly from the breast, but, you know, 4, 6, 8 ounces at a time is not uncommon. But it really, it makes a big difference, and there are a lot of moms. So thank you very, very much for your donations. Thank you for the work that you're doing. It really makes a huge difference for these babies, and it saves lives. It really does. It's huge.
So what kind of outreach or media are you doing to get more donors? And
well, it's,
and do the hospitals, obviously, it'll be easy to let them know.
Right. Doing a lot of education with hospitals and the staff in hospitals, just how to talk to moms about, if you notice a mom that may be a potential donor, or mom, WIC clinics, talking to a lot of the WIC people who work in WIC clinics and identifying moms. It's interesting, we have not put on our website or really that we're open yet, but yet we already have 31 people. We're getting a lot of calls from moms who are interested, hearing about us through social media outlets or a friend of a friend. So we did get permission from Himbana to go ahead and start screening donors, and then once we have their blessing to start pasteurizing milk, we're going to start really spreading the word that we're open and looking for donors.
Great. Yes. Is there a shelf life on the milk? How long can you hang on to it?
6 months from the time it's pasteurized.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I did. I mean, I had a freezer stocked full of it.
A mom who's at home pumping and putting milk in her freezer can last up to 12 months. But once it's been pasteurized, 6 months.
Do you think that there's, do other banks experience a lot of waste, or does it,
No. Wow. Usually their outgoing freezers are empty.
Well, thank you so much. I know that when Lauren brought you in to tell me about it, I thought this would be so interesting. And I hope there are some people watching that have learned something from this and will maybe be potential donors.
That would be great. And if you're in the area, our bank is just a little west of St. Vincent in Portland.
In my district.
That would be wonderful.
Great. Again, thank you so very much.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you for your time.
Now, Sandy.
Yeah, you ask.
That's it?
I think
we will officially adjourn. Thank you.